Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to TorahMediaAtlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.
It is November the 3rd, Rosh Chodesh Kislev, and we are in Parshas Mishpatim on page 424. And we are up to Pasuk Lamed Zion, verse 37. Ki gnov ishor oseh utvacha o mecharo. A man will steal a bull or a sheep, and he will either slaughter it or sell it. Chamisha v'kar yishalem tachas hashor. He pays 5 cattle in place of the bull. Va'abad son tachas haseh, and 4 sheep in place four sheep in place of the sheep that he stole. So there is a penalty over here that rather than paying for one bull or one sheep, which is all that he stole, instead he has to pay 5 and 4 and 5 times. 5 for the bull and 4, what else did I say, right? 5 for the bull and 4 for the sheep. So this is a penalty, obviously, and it only applies to a bull or to a sheep. It's the only ones it applies to. And it only applies if a person steals it and then sells it or slaughters it. If a person just steals it, then the regular halakha for theft would apply. We haven't even gotten to that yet, exactly how much you pay for theft. Obviously, we turn the object that you stole, but whether they want us to pay more than that, we'll see later on. But as far as the special penalty of the sheep and the bull, that is only if they are, after being stolen, they are then sold and or slaughtered. Now, the commentaries discuss over here, really the Gemara itself discusses over here, why is it that a sheep and a bull, why would the bull be paying, why would you pay 5 times and the sheep 4 times? Forget the question for a moment of why for these two animals you pay more than for regular theft. But comparing the one animal to the other, why is it that for one pays 5 times and the other one only 4 times?
The bull reproduces other cattle.
Well, the sheep also produces.
Yeah, but the sheep only is just one. A bull can support many.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I mean, any male animal can support many.
And they are consequently more valued.
Yeah.
Felix said
by farmers.
Bigger dimension of the size of a bull.
But a bull also is probably stronger than a.
Well, that's true. But you're paying. Remember, you're paying the amount and multiplying that. You're paying it times the amount of the bull. So you're right, a bull is larger and a bull is stronger, but you're already taking that into account. Now, let's say a bull costs $1,000 and a sheep costs $800. So for the bull, you're paying $5,000, and for the sheep, you're only paying $320. $3,200. Why 5 times the bull and 4 times the sheep?
Just read it in there. Okay.
Does it have anything to do with the gestation period between the sheep and the cow?
That's a good question. The Gemara does not say that that's the reason. The Gemara says 2 reasons. The Gemara says that a bull works. That's what an owner does with the bull. When you take away the bull from the person, then you have, what's that?
Then you're taking part of his livelihood.
Yeah, he can't work right now, so his field can't get plowed. You're delaying the work. Whereas the sheep just hangs around. A sheep produces wool, and you're not retarding his business by removing the sheep from his possession for a month. So when he gets it back, he'll shear the sheep and he'll go on from there. So you haven't messed up his business. So because of the fact that the bull is more integral to daily work, therefore one has to pay 5 times instead of only 4 times. That's one explanation. Another explanation is because with the bull, a bull will follow wherever you lead it. I mean, we're not talking about a bull that's ready to gore. I mean, but if you lead it, it goes. And the sheep is more difficult to get it to go where you want it to go. And as a result, the thief has to pick up the sheep and carry it in order to get it to go where he wants it to go. And that is embarrassing. It's a little bit embarrassing to have to carry the sheep around. So because he has to be shamed in carrying the sheep, therefore the penalty is reduced. Now, before you say that we're being nice to the thief who doesn't deserve any kindness, we're not being nice to him. He still has to pay four times the value of what he stole, which is pretty steep. But we don't make it five times the value because he does suffer a little bit in what he does. So it's not that we feel bad for him, but we don't need to punish him even more. So that's the difference between the sheep and the bull. But we still have to ask ourselves the overall question, which is, why these two animals more than any other animal? Why do these two animals, why is it that the Torah requires that one pays so many more times its value, whether it's four or five? And why is this only true if it's stolen and then sold, or stolen and then slaughtered?
I think these are the most common animals to be stolen.
Okay. So in an agricultural society, in a farming society, you're going to have, these animals are certainly going to be the most common. The bull and the sheep are certainly the most common. They are also, as Mr. Starkman said, the most common to be brought as sacrifices. You can also bring a goat as a sacrifice, but sheep and cows are definitely the most common. That's for sure. There's certain birds that can be brought, but sheep and cows are certainly the most, cow or bull, are certainly going to be the most common types of animals brought as sacrifices, and they are the most common types of animals around in a farming society. And so it seems that the Torah is accounting for the most common type of theft and punishing it more severely in order to prevent people from doing that. But why is it that we would only punish them in this way if they then sell or slaughter the animal? A thief who steals something, well, a thief is a thief, he steals something. When a thief steals something, so a person can steal something in order to use it, and a person can steal something in order to keep it. To get benefit from, well, no one, rarely does someone steal it and then just hide it away. Usually they steal it and they use it. But there's use that consumes it, and there's use that doesn't consume it. So when cash is stolen, the reason why it's very hard to get it back is because the thief usually spends it immediately and then they have no money to pay you. So that's the most common thing to happen to cash. You never get it back because it's gone after the thief has it. But things can be stolen and used. If a person steals a car and then uses the car, so that's one thing. It can still be returned. When cars are stolen in this country, which unfortunately happens frequently, as was explained to me about 3 months after we got married and our car was stolen, the officer and then the insurance company explained to us that the most common thing that's done with a stolen car is it's driven until it runs out of gas, and then it's abandoned. That's the most common thing. In some areas, they strip them, but that's rare. That's what happens in certain places in the United States, but most of the time that's not what happens. Most of the time, they're driven until they run out of gas, and then the thief goes on to the next one. That's the most common thing that happens.
Don't keep much gas in your car and you'll find it.
That's why the insurance company waits for a little while before paying out, because they're hoping the car will be found and be in relatively good shape, and they can return it as is. That's what we discovered when this happened. And in fact, they were correct. In our case, the car had been stolen, and then it was not found, and the insurance company paid us for the car. A few months later, the car was discovered. The thief had parked it on a residential street, so no one realized that it was a stolen car. And it was only after it sat there for many months that somebody realized it shouldn't be there, and they called the cops and they discovered it was a stolen car. But by that point, the insurance company owned it already because they had paid us for it. So that was just a case in point. But stealing a car and driving it until it runs out of gas is bad. Stealing a car and then selling it for parts so that it gets completely demolished, there is a certain it's a greater criminality. There's a certain criminal mindset in doing that. If I need something right now to use it, so it's wrong to steal, a person may steal and do it. It's bad. But when a person already has a system where they steal it and they sell it, that's already a business. And that's far worse than someone who just steals once in a while for something which is bad enough. Slaughtering it as well, if they're slaughtering it, generally speaking, remember, we're not talking about in the days of refrigeration. What did you do when you slaughtered an entire bull?
To saw all the pieces.
You got to do something with all that meat.
Right.
Most of the time, it meant that you sold it. What did you do with it? You can't eat the whole thing, certainly not in one sitting, and it was not going to remain fresh enough. You could, theoretically, you could salt it, and you can preserve it. But it's most likely it's going to be given out to other people. It's not going to be a single person working himself. So the person steals a bull and uses it to plow his field. He steals a tractor and uses it to plow his field. It's bad. But it's different than turning it into a business, where it becomes something of a more regular type of thing. Yeah.
So this is only if they get caught.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you lose out completely if the person isn't caught with your sheep or your bull selling it. And do they have to be warned?
Well, before you say that, I'm not sure what you...
The witnesses.
But what do you mean only if they get caught? I mean, what happens if anything is stolen and the person's not caught? Why?
Well, I know. That's what I'm saying. I was thinking originally this is a deterrent if you have to pay this much for doing it, but then if you're really good and you don't get caught, it means nothing.
If you're a really good thief. Baruch Atah Adonai Eloheinu Melech Haolam
Shehakol Nivra.
Amen. You got to be good at your job.
Yeah, exactly.
My Rosh Yeshiva of Weinberg, Zechon Baruch, blessed memory, said that, I think I've mentioned this to you before, in the question of whether to support the death penalty or not. So he said that anybody who thinks that the reason why the death penalty is effective is because it frightens the criminals into not doing that which they will be killed for, mm-hmm. does not understand how the death penalty works and does not understand the criminal mind. A person who feels that he wants to commit a crime for whatever reason will do it and try to get away with it. And the fact that there is a death penalty imposed is not going to stop the vast majority of people who are already doing something as violent as an act that would require the death penalty. Rather, the way the death penalty works to prevent crime is the death penalty is a statement that society does not tolerate this act. People don't like to do things that society does not tolerate. It's one thing to do things that the wealthy people don't tolerate, but my buddies will slap me on the back for and tell me I'm really a good guy or I'm really cool or whatever it is. So then I'll do it. But something which people don't tolerate, society doesn't tolerate, it's not done. People don't like to do that. And the death penalty is a message that this is so intolerable that we will remove the person permanently if they act this way. And this is partially why the death penalty in the United States does very little to prevent crime. Because it doesn't, even when it happens, it takes years and years and years and years before it happens. Mm-hmm. And when it finally does happen, it is done in such a painless way that it does not send any kind of message to anybody. It's so by the time a person is killed for it, what they did, the only ones who remember anymore are the victim's relatives. Mm-hmm. That's it. Mm-hmm. No one else remembers the act anymore. It becomes something of the past. And therefore it loses its sharpness. It loses what it could do. When you have a penalty of this nature in the Torah, it's not that it stops people because they are afraid of having to pay so much money. It stops people because it is so intolerable. Look what the Torah does to you if you take somebody's sheep or bull and sell it or slaughter it. That's the message that's being sent over here. I have to tell you that I've seen this countless times, this concept, that the you find in I'll talk from my own experience rather than say you find, because I can't speak from experience now. But when I was in yeshiva in high school, so the first 2/3 of the day was spent studying Judaic studies, primarily Gemara, and that was the first 2/3 of the day till 2:30 in the afternoon, and then we had a short break, and then we had our secular studies, and the secular studies went till dinner time. Now, the behavior of the students was decidedly better in Judaic studies than it was with secular studies. Now, part of the reason for that is, of course, because once you get to that late in the afternoon, it's very difficult for people to continue. So it's a grueling schedule, and if you're going to pick any time of the day to kick back a little bit, well, 2:30 to 6:30 in the afternoon is going to be the more likely time than 9 to 12 in the morning. Mm-hmm. But in addition, the Judaic studies were taught by rabbis who were very well respected, who conducted themselves in a very respectful manner and demanded respect from their students. And the secular department very often was the people who taught the subjects were not necessarily conducting themselves in the most respectful manner and didn't dress necessarily in the most respectful manner and didn't demand respect in the same way. That also contributed. But really, really what contributed to it is that, just to speak in the high school vernacular, it was uncool to act up in Judaics. It just wasn't. It wasn't. You didn't. If you acted up, no one laughed. No one thought it was. No one thought it was. It was cool or neat or anything like that. You weren't respected for acting up in Judaic studies. If you acted up in the afternoon, well, you know how high school boys are, right? You do something funny, everybody laughs. That's the way. That's a typical high school reaction. But it wasn't cool to do it in Judaics. It wasn't for threat of punishment. It was because that was the attitude of the students. And no one wanted to act in a way that their peers would think that they were in the wrong, that they weren't acting properly. And that was the biggest deterrent, more than any threats and more than any demands from the faculty. It was primarily peer pressure. That people would tolerate or not tolerate certain behaviors. Same thing in the dormitory. In the dormitory, it was fun to act up because who didn't like it when someone acted up in the dormitory? That was a time where you could earn your friends' respect by acting up. So, okay. So this is unique to stealing a bull or a sheep, and unique to then slaughtering it and or selling it. Okay, we may come back to this a little bit later, but right now we're going to move on to the next discussion. Pasuk Aleph, verse 1. Im b'machteres yimatzei haganav, if in a tunnel the thief will be found, v'huka v'mes, and he is struck and he dies, ein lo damim, he has no blood. Meaning, if the owner of the house through which the thief is tunneling to get to discovers the thief and kills him, he has no blood, meaning we treat him as if he's already dead. We do not punish the owner of the house. Im zarcha Hashem ashalav, if the sun shines upon him, damim lo, then he has blood. Shalem yeshalem, he shall pay. Im ein lo, if he doesn't have anything to pay with, v'nimkar b'gnevaso, and he is sold for his theft. Im himatzei simatzei b'yado ha'gneva, if the stolen object is found on his person, it's found with him, mishor, not on his person, but with him, mishor ad chamor ad sechayim, from a bull to a donkey to a sheep that is still alive, shnayim yishalem, he shall pay double. There's a whole bunch of information packed into these few verses. We have to go through them very carefully. First, we need to get the simple reading of some of these words, which don't seem to make sense reading them at face value. First of all, we have the case of the machteres. The machteres is a baba machteres, someone who comes in a tunnel. He's tunneling into the person's house to steal something. Now, even though this is in the context of stealing a bull or a sheep, this would apply to stealing anything. It's not only a bull or a sheep. Any kind of theft that is going on, this would apply. Before going further, let me distinguish between the word geneva and the word gizela. Here it says geneva, as it says in the previous pasuk, previous verse, ki yignov ish, which means when a man will steal. And here as well, in the last verse, in verse 3, pasuk gimel, it says, ihu yatzei simatzei biado hagneva, the stolen item. Or in pasuk aleph in verse 1, im b'machteres imatzei haganov, if the ganov, the thief, is found in this tunnel. A ganov is a thief, and a gazlon is a thief. They're both thieves. But here the Torah is speaking specifically about a ganov as opposed to a gazlon.
Is there a difference?
What's the difference? So a ganov is a thief that steals on the sly without anybody seeing. That's a ganov. Someone who breaks into an empty home or breaks in the middle of the night when everybody's sleeping and takes something and runs, that is a ganov. A gazlan is someone who steals in broad daylight, who swipes it right in front of your eyes and takes off. That's a gazlan. Someone who grabs something out of your hand and runs, a purse snatcher, is a gazlan. This is not speaking about that. This is speaking about a ganav, someone who steals. I think in English the word burglar and to steal, I think it's two different words, right? I really don't know, that I'm not familiar with the differences, but I know that I think they do mean something slightly different. I think these are the distinctions. The
difference between a burglar and a robber.
Okay, what is what?
I don't know. I just know there is.
It, from Yiddish, they must have adapted that. This is a ganav.
Mm-hmm. So a ganav means a thief.
Yeah.
Right? But it means a specific type of thief.
Yeah, no,
it means one who does it slyly.
Yeah, right.
As opposed to a gazlan.
I think, I don't know which, but one breaks in and one burglar.
Maybe sneak thief would be a term for a gun.
Perhaps.
One has
more than
the other.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. The gazlan does it in front of you.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. So here we're talking about a ganav, one who steals slyly, where people, he doesn't want anybody to see him. The Torah says that if this thief, he tunnels into the house, so there are two things that happen to this thief. There's two distinguishing properties about this thief. The Torah says he doesn't have any blood, which means that we treat him as if he's already dead, which means the owner of the house has license to kill this person. We'll talk about that in a moment. But there is a rule in the Torah that says that if a person does something for which there are two punishments, then he only receives the worse of the two punishments. So that means if a person, let's say, murders, God forbid, so they take a gun and they shoot someone and kill them. In the process of killing them, the bullet rips through their clothing and damages the clothing the person is wearing. Now, the murderer is going to be put to death. Do we also charge his estate for the clothing of the victim? And the answer is no, we don't. Because since it was in one act that the damage and the murder occurred, so we only put him to death. We don't charge him for the money as well. Now the truth is, one could argue over there, as the Gemara does, that the clothing actually gets damaged prior to the death of the person, in which case one might be able to argue that in that case it's two separate acts. It's damaging the clothing, killing the person. And that is a discussion of the Gemara, which is beyond the scope of our discussion tonight. But I'm just trying to give you an idea here of the same act doing two things, but we would only punish for the more severe one. Now that, to most people, makes sense. It's something which rings with the truth to us. We don't have a problem with that. And once we have two different punishments to give, give the more stringent punishment and ignore the more lenient punishment. What is sometimes difficult for people to accept is that this is true even if in the end we don't kill the person. Let's say there's a technicality, and because of the technicality, we're not going to kill the person. For instance, there was no warning. Usually, in order to put someone to death, there has to be a warning. Witnesses have to say to him, if you pull that trigger, we're going to put you to death. And then he says, I don't care, and he pulls the trigger. So, if there is no warning, then we don't put him to death. So one may say, well, if we're not putting him to death, then we should give him the lesser punishment of paying for the damages. But we don't do that either. Because since part of what he did was an act that involved a punishment more severe than payment, then the payment is ignored, even if in the end we don't give him the death penalty. Here, the reason why you need to know this is because this person breaking into the house is considered to be without blood, which means we consider him dead already. The owner of the house has license to kill this person. Because he has license to kill this person, if the person does damage the house, damage things in the property while they are there, they are not liable for the damages, even if they get away without being killed. Because since essentially the Torah is pronouncing the death penalty on this person, the owner can kill him for breaking into the house, therefore the damages that they do while breaking into the house, they are not liable for payment. And I say this to you before I explain the whole thing because of the next verse. Im zarcha Hashem eshalav, if the sun shines on him, the Gemara says this is a metaphor. But if the sun shines on him, then damim lo, then he has blood, which means in a case where the sun shines on him, which we'll explain in a moment what that means. That the simple meaning would seem to be if he does it during daylight.
Yeah.
Right. But we'll explain in a moment what it really means. Then he has blood. If he has blood, that means that the owner cannot kill him. And therefore, shalem yishalem, he must pay. Because since he's not liable for the death penalty, therefore he has to pay. So what I'm showing you is that it's one or the other. Either he's liable to be killed, or he has to pay, but not both. Now, why would the owner here be allowed to kill this person? And this is where we learn in the Torah the concept of the preemptive strike. The Six-Day War, which was predicated on the preemptive strike, is derived from right here in the Torah. How do we know that the Torah says that haba lahar gecha, if someone is coming to kill you, hashkem lahar go, kill him first? Where do we learn that from? We learn it from right over here. This is something that distinguishes our Torah from most other religions in the world. Most other religions in the world do not have a clause that permits or even encourages a preemptive strike. We do. And this is it. That if someone is out to kill you, then you should kill them first before they kill you. Yes?
But Rabbi Francis, I thought
he was just running away. Okay, so hold on. So let's explain. If a person is walking by a house and sees the door is open and no one's minding the store, the door's open, there's no car in the driveway, it appears like someone just left the door open. So they walk into the house, look around, they see some valuables, they grab them and run. That person has seized an opportunity. They're wrong, they're evil, but all they've done is they seized an opportunity. Someone who breaks into a home, here the case is tunneling, but someone who breaks into a home is not seizing an opportunity. That's a person who has planned to steal from this house. That's not someone who happened to walk by and happened to notice an open door. This is someone who has planned a break-in. When someone plans a break-in, then a person thinks ahead. And when they think ahead, they arrive at one inescapable conclusion. That is, that if I'm breaking into this house, and the owner discovers me breaking into this house, the owner is not going to be too happy about it. And very likely, the owner will try to stop me from doing it. Therefore, if I'm breaking into the house, knowing that the owner is likely going to stop me if they discover me, I am prepared for that eventuality. How am I prepared for that eventuality? I'm prepared because I'm carrying a weapon. Or I feel that I am myself a weapon. And I am ready to kill the owner if they try to stop me. Which means, I'm not out to kill necessarily. I'm out for money. I'm out for valuables. But because these valuables are behind locked doors, and I know the owner may try to stop me, therefore I am prepared for the possibility of needing to kill the owner. Therefore the Torah says, this thief is actually a murderer. They haven't murdered in their lives. They've never murdered anybody in their lives, but they're prepared to murder. Someone who is prepared to murder you, you are to kill him first, even though they have not drawn a weapon. Even though they're still digging into your house. They haven't even gotten into the house yet. They're just digging the tunnel. And they're underneath, they're in the tunnel. They don't have a weapon. They are not holding a weapon. But they are digging underneath in that tunnel to get into the house. Torah says, if you discover that person, shoot him. Kill him. Right there. Don't ask questions. Shoot first. Ask questions later. This is her sanctions, a preemptive strike. This person who's tunneling to the house is a dead man. We treat him like a dead man. We have pronounced the death penalty on this man. Because he's prepared to kill, therefore the owner of the house is to kill this person first. If the sun is shining upon him, the Gemara says this is a metaphor, which means, if it is obvious that this person is not out to kill, it's clear to anybody this person is not out to kill. Now, what case would that be? So the Gemara's example is, let's say it is a father tunneling into his son's house. So a parent is not going to kill their child. Not on purpose anyway. And therefore, if a parent is tunneling into a child's house, or something similar to that, the Gemara says, two very good friends, and one is tunneling into the other one's house. So the sun is shining upon that person, which means that it's obvious they're not out to murder. It's obvious they're not out to murder, therefore one should not kill that person. The person does have blood. They're not considered to be a dead man, and the owner should not kill that person. And since that's the case, therefore the tunneler is now liable to pay for whatever they take, whatever they break, whatever it is, they are liable to pay. This should not be confused with a different law in the Torah, which is the law of Rodef. What is the law of Rodef? The law of Rodef is that if I see one Jew chasing after another Jew with intent to kill that Jew, then I am, if the only way for me to stop the aggressor and save the victim is to kill the aggressor, then I am to kill the aggressor before the aggressor kills the victim. That's the law of Rodef. That's a different law than this. That is where the weapon has been drawn. The person is clearly out to kill. They're not out to steal. It's not that someone is trying to steal from somebody else. It's that someone is trying to kill somebody else. And I see the person is out to kill the other person. Then if I can prevent the murder in some fashion other than killing the aggressor, I'm obligated to do that first. If I can wound the aggressor, if I can remove the victim from harm's way, I need to do that. But if there's no way to prevent the murder other than preemptively killing the aggressor, then I am to kill the aggressor first. That case is where the murder is the agenda. This case, theft is the agenda. It's a different case. Here it's a preemptive strike because the Torah has been yored l'sof daito. The Torah has literally gone down to the end of his thinking, has worked his thinking out all the way to the end. And the Torah says this person who is out for valuables is a potential murderer. Therefore, kill him first. it's very significant to understand this difference between rodef, where I see someone chasing after another person, and this case of Baba Machteres, this case of tunneling into the house. Let me give you a very, very clear distinction between the two. I mentioned that in the case of rodef, where I see one person chasing after another person, so there the law is that if I can prevent the murder by pulling the victim out of harm's way, then that's what I should do. So if I see one person sneaking up to try to kill another person, and I have the ability to run ahead of the aggressor, get to the victim, grab the victim, put him in my car and drive off, then that's what I should do. Get him out of harm's way as quickly as possible. That's what I should do. Let's say the thief is breaking into the person's house. The thief has broken into the house. It's the middle of the night. They've broken into the house. They're searching for valuables. So the owner of the house is in the house and knows that there's a burglar in his house. He has two choices. He owns a gun and he could go down and shoot the burglar. He could do that. There's also an open window in his room and he's on the ground floor and there's no one else in the house and he could simply climb out the window, run away and call the cops. Mm-hmm. Now all of us would certainly recommend the second because that would be the safer thing to do. Is the person allowed to take his gun and sneak up on the burglar and shoot him in the back? The Torah says, absolutely. If he's burglarizing the house, he broke into the house, then it is 100% acceptable for the owner of the house, even if he has recourse to do something else, it is 100% permissible, sanctioned for him to sneak up on that burglar and shoot him in the back. Because he's burglarizing the house, which means that burglar is a would-be murderer. And therefore, the preemptive strike allows for killing him. You don't have to. If you want, you can get out the window and run away. You can do that too, and perhaps that's the safer thing to do. But the point is that this burglar, we treat him as if he is a murderer. 100%.
He starts going downstairs. The burglar runs. He's got a gun. He chases.
Now the burglar's out of the house.
Yeah.
Once he's out of the house, the rules change. While he's in the house. Once he's run off, now he's a burglar who has run off, and now all the rules of theft will apply.
Right.
You can't kill him anymore. But as long as he's in the house, he's fair game. Yeah.
Okay, so... Oh, you can't kill him anymore.
So you might want to, but you can't.
Shoot him in the leg and
all right,
run away.
So the burglar runs out of the house. The owner of the house chases after him outside of the house with a gun. And a third person, the owner of the house, chasing after the burglar.
Good.
And that third person shoots the owner of the house.
That's correct. That's right. And in that case, the third person would be correct because the owner of the house is running after someone who is no longer liable for death. They were liable for death as long as they were breaking into the house. But once they've gotten out of the house...
They become the victim.
Right. Because they have to pay back, but they don't deserve the death penalty anymore. So you're absolutely right. The Gemara says, interestingly, that... the Gemara says this, that we'll get to this later on, but it'll take us a while. You know the story with Pinchas. Mm-hmm. Pinchas sees Zimri, and Zimri has taken the Midiani woman and Cosby, right? And he is having a relationship with her in a public manner. It's in a tent, but everybody knows what's going on. So it's in a public manner. So it is a desecration of God's name. And the halacha over there is that the zealot should kill them. And therefore Pinchas gets up with a sword and he's ready to kill them. And he does. And he kills them. But because this is the rule of a zealot, which we'll talk about when we get to that story, but it's the rule of a zealot, of a kanoi, it only applies as long as the act is going on.
Right.
Once they are finished, then the zealot is no longer allowed to kill in that manner anymore. It has to go through a court system. It can't just be the zealot running up and killing them. So the Gemara says that if Zimri would have seen Pinchas coming to kill him and Zimri would have killed Pinchas instead, Zimri would not have been liable for murder because he was doing it in self-defense. How crazy is that? Was that?
But he was guilty.
He was guilty, but he was not guilty of a court-ordered death penalty, which is different. A court-ordered death penalty, if the executioner is about to kill the criminal, and the criminal wants to defend himself and tries to kill the executioner, that would be a sin. He's not allowed to do that. But here, in this case, it would be a case of a rodef, even though it was sanctioned, but since it's not a court-ordered thing, it would still be a rodef. That's a little bit difficult to understand, but I'm just showing you that you can have situations where the tables get turned, where the criminal becomes the victim. It can happen. There are situations where it can happen, although it's rare. Yeah.
So is this why the Torah is so specific about how exactly Pinchas killed Zimri and Husby?
Yes.
Okay, good.
Yes.
I agree with this gentleman that, you know, not everything is black or white. We don't know what somebody's intentions is. Somebody's intention could be just to rob. He has no, you know, plan of killing either way. And, you know, then he gets put in a situation. By the same token, the man who's walking on the street and sees a door open, he still makes the conscious decision to go in there. So if the conscious decision is made 5 minutes before he does it or 2 weeks before,
Good. So just first let's answer the first point you made, which is that there is a discussion in the Gemara whether, see, the way that we read it, which is the simple reading of the verses, is that if the sun shines on the person, which means it's obvious that they're not out to kill, then you can't kill the person.
Wait, one second.
That means the implication is that if you're not sure, then you can kill the person. And that's the way we read it. The default is that a burglar, you kill him. If he breaks into a house, you kill him. Unless you're 100% sure that he's not out to kill. That's the way we read it. There is an opinion in the Gemara to read it the other way around, which is that only if you're sure that the person is out to murder, then you kill the person. But if you're unsure, then you don't kill the person. That's the other way to read it. But the prevailing opinion is the first way, which is why I read it that way, which is that if you're not sure, the default is you kill him. That's if you're not sure. It's only if you're sure that he's not out to kill. That's the prevailing opinion in the Gemara. Now, the other point you made, which is what about the person who sees the open door and seizes the opportunity? The thinking is that when a person sees an open door, he thinks he can run in, grab, and run out. And he believes he will not encounter the owner. You see, what happens in a case where the house appears to be empty and someone breaks into the house, but it's not empty? See, in that case, one could argue that's a case where the sun is shining upon the person because the person presumed the house to be empty. So he doesn't think he's going to encounter an owner of the house. If I'm planning this thing out, then I'm more likely to carry a weapon. If I just happen to notice an open door, it's an opportunity. So I'm not necessarily ready to kill. I don't have any weapons with me.
Or,
yeah, I'm not saying it's impossible for him to have a weapon, but it doesn't mean that he's thought it through to that point. The Torah is presuming that the person has thought it through all the way. And when the person seizes an opportunity, they haven't necessarily thought it all the way through. Yeah.
I understand the difference between, you know, one is tunneling, the intention, and plan. But where does the part of compassion and the Rachmanis fit? Because
for Rachmanis for who?
No, the Ghana. Because sometimes people still, because they're hungry, there's no food, and they're doing it. Don't the judges trying to find out?
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. That is from Shamayim. They can think about that. We do not take that into consideration. There is no Rachmanis when someone does something which is overtly against the Torah. We can't do that. You can't. A court system cannot act that way. That destroys a judicial system. It cannot be based on emotions. It has to be based on cold hard facts. The person broke in, did what they did, they need to be punished for it. Now, the from Shamayim, there will be Rachmanis. If the person deserves Rachmanis, that's true. But you can't have a judicial system that works that way. That will destroy the whole system. Right? Similarly, if we're going to put someone to death, we don't take into account the fact that there's going to be an orphan and a widow. We can't. How could we do that? Then it's going to be, you pick and choose. It can't be like that. We don't kill a person for stealing. We're talking about the person who's broken into the house, and we presume that the owner of the house's life is in danger. We don't kill for stealing. No, what happens after the person steals? And that's really what we have to get up to over here. If the person does steal, then he has to pay back. And if he can't pay back... Okay, so that was what the verse says. Im Elo, if he can't pay, vinim kar b'gneva, so then he is sold for his theft. So here is... In Pasuk Beis, verse 2. Here we have the... We already had some rules of Eved Ivri, of a Jewish slave. Now we have an example for how a person becomes a Jewish slave. How could a person become a Jewish slave? Well, one example could be a person is destitute and they sell themselves into slavery. But another example could be a person is destitute and they steal, and then they don't have the money to pay back. They are sold by the court into slavery. It still follows the same rules. It's a 6-year term of slavery. The person is a Jewish slave. He has all the rules of any other Jew. He has to be treated properly, and the owner of the slave has to support this person's family, his wife and his children. All the rules we had before apply here as well. And the payment to purchase the slave is the amount that the slave stole. So if he stole $1,000, then the purchase price is $1,000. If he stole $10,000, the purchase price is $10,000. If the owner of the slave pays the price of the value of the theft, and that the thief works off his theft for 6 years. Those following all the rules we had in the beginning of Parshas Mishpatim of Eved Ivri. It says, "V'nimkar b'gneva," so he is sold for his theft. The Gemara tells us that only a man can be sold into slavery for theft, not a woman. A woman cannot be sold into slavery for theft. If she steals and she doesn't have the money, then she has a debt. And anybody who has a debt, what do you do if you have a debt? You have to work, and the court will assess how much of your wages you keep for yourself and how much of your wages go towards paying back the debt. And that's whatever typical thing happens whenever there's a debt. So a woman who steals cannot be sold as a slave. Instead, whatever money is earned, the court will determine how much she needs to live on, and then the rest of it will go to pay for the debt. But if a man steals and doesn't have what to pay back, then he is sold into slavery. Yeah?
So this means there are no Jewish
women slaves? We had before, we talked about a Jewish woman slave, right? But that was a young girl who was sold only by her father, and it was only in order to make ends meet, and it was only to set her up for marriage. We talked about it in great detail in the beginning of the parsha. And finally, just so we finish off this paragraph, although we probably should continue this next time, if the object is found in his hand, the Pasuk Gimel, if it's found in his hand, and it lists various examples, and a bull, and a donkey, and a sheep, if it's still alive, he pays double. So why does it say if he's still alive? Because if he slaughters it, he has to pay 4 or 5 times for the bull or for the sheep. So here, it's still alive. And so if it's still alive and it's in his hand, he hasn't sold it, then he pays double. This is the rule of kefel. Kefel means double, paying double. And it applies to a ganav, to one who steals on the sly. It does not apply to a gazlan, to someone who steals in the open. It only applies to a ganav. So a ganav, one who steals, he got away with the theft. I should say he got away. He got away with his life. He wasn't killed, and he got away. He got out of the house. He ran away. And then he's caught. Then he pays double for the theft. So he has to pay the item plus the same amount again. That's the rule of kefel. The Gemara discusses why is it that a ganav, one who steals on the sly, is treated more severely than a gazlan, than someone who steals out in the open. Why is one worse than the other? And the Gemara tells us that the ganav in a certain way is worse than the gazlan. Why is a ganav worse than a gazlan? Because the ganav says, I don't want anybody to see me steal. So I'll steal in the dark, I'll steal on the sly, I don't want anybody to see me. The gazlan says, I don't care if anybody sees me, I'll just do it. So why is the ganav worse? Because the ganav says, I don't want anybody to see me. But Hashem sees him. So he's putting fear of man over fear of God. Say, I don't care about God seeing me, I just don't want people to see me. Most people, all of us, when, God forbid, we sin, that's the way we think. We don't want human beings to see us because we're embarrassed. And we should be embarrassed. But most of the time, we ignore the fact that we are being seen by Hashem. And that has with it a certain rejection of Hashem. And that's why it's a little bit worse. Whereas the gazlan, who's willing to walk up to the outdoor fruit stand, grab an orange and run, everybody sees it, it may be brazen, it may be terrible, but he's not putting fear of man over fear of God. And that's why he, of course, he has to pay back, but not double. He would not have to pay double for that.
What does he have to pay?
He has to pay back what he stole.
That's it.
Yeah, he has to pay back what he stole. We're not talking about armed robbery. Armed robbery is a whole different discussion. That we're not discussing. We talk about gazlan, we're talking about just walking up, grabbing something and running. That's bad. We're not talking about armed robbery or mugging or something like that. That's a whole different story.
That occurs as a result of business fraud or electronic fraud, bank transfers, sneaky stuff, Ponzi schemes, whatever.
Yeah.
That, what is that?
Okay, so you're asking embezzlement, things of that nature.
Yeah.
So there is a big difference between money that is taken and money that is given, which means that if you give me something and then I don't return it to you, then that is not in the Torah called theft. It's called a debt. I owe it to you, but it is not called theft. The Torah treats much more severely when I reach into your possession and take something and run. But if you hand it to me, or give it to me, or whatever it is, in some way or other, even if you're tricked into giving it to me, but you did hand it to me, and therefore it is not treated as severely, of course I have to pay back no matter what it is, but it's not the same level. Now, when we deal with electronic theft, that's a good question, because there's no physical act of reaching in and grabbing. It's all out there in the,
but you're reaching and grabbing electronically.
Right. So that's a good question. How will we treat that? Is that treated like physically grabbing something or not? And that's a good question which I don't know the answer to. That would be depend on how to handle this. That would be a modern day question of whether hitting the keys on the keyboard or whatever it is that called an act of reaching in and grabbing?
But
it's hard to know.
Because the intent is evil.
Of course the intent is evil, but all theft, the intent is evil. All theft is evil. We're not minimizing theft. It's a terrible thing no matter how it's done. But there are gradations in the way the Torah treats it.
For those of you who do catch up online with this class, and if you access it through Torah Media Atlanta, you should be aware that Yisrael Killian, who runs Torah Media Atlanta, reached out because donations to that site are down. He does not make money off the site, but he does need money in order to run the site. Those of you who do take advantage of it, I would suggest making a donation online when you do use it so that he can continue that site.